Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Rich Martini. You've heard what we've been talking about. Plus, we'll take a few moments here and talk about one of his works on the search for Amelia Earhart's plane and what has happened with that. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Rich, before we talk a little bit about Amelia Earhart and take phone calls, sure. Where do people get your work and steer us to a place?
Well, let's see. You can find me at richmartini.com. That's the easiest thing. I keep everything up to date there. And in terms of flipsidethebook.com and flipsidethefilm.com are both sites that I built so people could access this information. And I've got quite a few YouTube videos. Just recently, I did a book talk here in Venice, and when I was talking about my past life as an American Indian, a woman in the audience started crying, and Scott DeTambell happened to be in the audience. So he did a live session with her right there in the spot. It's about a half hour. I put it on YouTube. It's pretty startling. She quickly goes into a past life memory of being an American Indian, where she experienced the same sort of thing. So YouTube, anything to Flipside or Martini, you will find me. So often stirred but rarely shaken, as I'm fond of saying.
One of your works, a DVD on Amelia Earhart's Electra, her plane. Tell me about that.
Well, some years ago, I got a letter from an old friend of mine from high school, Abby Adams Yaffe, who said, you know, you should make a movie about Amelia Earhart. This was 89. So I wrote a screenplay, and I took it around, and I got interest from quite a few people. Diane Keaton at one point got interested, uh-huh. But she made another version, and then hired me as a consultant. And then years later, Philip Noyce was going to direct Amelia, Mira Nair, eventually did. But he hired me because he knew about all the research I had. I had just tons and tons and tons of research. But basically, nobody wanted to tell the story that I had found. And that is basically over 200 people saw her or claimed to have seen her after she disappeared in 1937. I couldn't figure out why people wouldn't listen to these people. So that's when I started researching and going into, and I started filming people, eyewitness people who saw her plane on Saipan in 1944 when U.S. Marines invaded Saipan in June. And June 18th, 1944, when they got to Aslito Airfield, they found her plane in a hangar. I interviewed Julius Erskine Neighbors, great name, a U.S. Marine from Tupelo, Mississippi, who decoded the message that came from SyncPAC, which is the military headquarters, that said, and I quote, "We have found Amelia Earhart's airplane at Aslito Airfield." And when he decoded the message, he took it to his commanding officer, a guy named Lewis Wallace. And he was surprised that Lewis Wallace didn't seem surprised by that. Once I've got into this research, I have interviewed at least six veterans who saw her plane. And, of course, six veterans, like 6 degrees of separation, they had six more friends who saw it as well. But these six guys saw her plane, and after a few weeks, they saw U.S. military destroy her plane. Took it out, dragged it onto the runway, covered it in gasoline, and shot it with a P-138.
Why would they do that?
Well, I try to avoid that question, because that's where people get trapped. When they try to say, well, here's why this happened. I just focused on the eyewitness reports. What did you see? How did you see it? What? Give me the dates. Give me the time. Show me the place. Now, I've heard theories, and I have my own theory, but my point is I just focused on eyewitness reports. And these Marines who, you know, at the VA hospital, their friends laugh at them. You didn't see your plane. Come on. You're making that up. And these guys, I just got a about 6 months ago, I got a call from a young guy who said, you know, you should talk to my dad and my uncle and the Bryce brothers. They're from Colorado. One guy was stationed on Majuro, and he was talking to a stevedore who transported her plane from where it had landed to a Japanese ship. Now, when they went to a reunion, the Bryce brothers, after World War II, one of them said, you know, I heard this story about Amelia Earhart's airplane. And the other brother said, well, I saw it. And he was on Saipan. And somebody that he was working with said, hey, you know, they found Amelia Earhart's airplane down there in the hangar. And he went down with this guy, and he said, I saw it. You know, it's 1937, 7 years earlier, it had disappeared. Everybody in the country knew what it looked like. An aluminum plane with, you know, and whatever that thing is in the back of her plane, the numbers. And he said, you know, everybody was talking about it as if it was her plane. I mean, and as he said, I can't imagine why anyone would make this up or have some kind of substitute. It just doesn't make sense. So ultimately, I can tell you what happened in a nutshell.
Great story. Go ahead.
She was supposed to fly around the world. As you know, there were three people on her plane initially. Harry Manning was going to be the radio operator, then Fred Noonan, her navigator, and then her. She crashed in Hawaii. Harry Manning got off the plane, said, I'm not flying with her anymore. I don't know why. Nobody knows why. But he was the radio man, and his plan that he had set up with the Itasca, which is the Coast Guard cutter that was going to communicate with her, was for her to be communicated with in Morse code. Okay? Nobody changed that plan. Elgin Long's book covers this, but I found it as well. A detail in her last book called Last Flight, she says specifically, I never learned Morse code and neither did Fred. Neither one of them spoke Morse code. So when you look at the logs, 90% of all the transmissions between her and the Itasca was in Morse code. Okay? Now, there's a theory about the dateline that Fred Noonan had gotten it wrong, and this is a NASA filmmaker who'd worked with NASA. She came up with it. It's on a website. I've seen it. She showed that if he had miscalculated, he would have been 200-some miles northwest of the island. So she had another 200 miles to go to get where everyone claims she landed. The queen of Milia, there's a guy named Oliver Nags, he's a reporter. He went to Milia Atoll back in the 1980s. He made a film, which no one's seen because the footage is in Florida somewhere. I've talked to somebody who shot it. But he interviewed islanders who saw her plane come down. Her plane came down in Milia Atoll. A Japanese troop came over and arrested her. They took the plane on a Japanese barge and transported it to Majuro. This is all eyewitness reports. They put her and the plane in Jaluit on the Kyushu, which is a Japanese seaplane tender, you know, with the crane in the back. A young medical assistant went aboard the ship and worked on her. There's an interview, it's in the documentary, with this guy who heard the Japanese calling her a Mira. The Japanese officer was speaking to her in English. Fred Noonan was badly injured. She was not. Also, the governor of the Marianas, when he was a little kid, he was standing out there and saw it on the Kyushu. The Marshall Islands, they had a commemorative stamp showing the Electra on the Kyushu in Jaluit. They issued that stamp some years ago. Ultimately, the plane was taken to Saipan. It was put on this Lido airfield. She was taken to a prison in Garapan where she spent the next 4 or 5 years of her life in this prison cell.
She didn't live too long after that.
Though. Well, that's pretty long. 5 years, you know, from 37 to 1942, roughly, she sat in this tiny cell, and Fred was down the hall from her. These are eyewitness reports. Huh. And then in 43, roughly, the U.S. shelled Saipan, and all the prisoners of war were taken out and executed. Thomas Devine had a letter from a woman, Michiko Sugita, whose father was the chief of police on Saipan, and he executed her, or had her executed. And she reported exactly what she saw, and there was an eyewitness. Connie Chung interviewed her. She's also in the documentary.
It's an amazing story.
You know, she saw Amelia shot. She was offered a blindfold. She refused it. She was shot. She was buried. Now, I've spoken to GIs who claimed that they knew that she had been dug up. And I tracked down the guy who was in charge of this mission. His name, and I'm going to tell it to you now for the first time, is James H. Nichols. He's a U.S. Navy guy who eventually went into the Office of Naval Intelligence and into the OSS and into the CIA. And he died in the CIA in the 1960s. He told his brother and his nephew this story that he had been tasked to either rescue Earhart or to cover up that she had been there. Why? I'm going to guess it's because we had broken the Japanese code, and if Japanese knew we were looking for Earhart, they would have known that we had broken their code.
That's right.
I guess. I don't know. That may be why, but, you know, all I know is this guy, James H. Nichols, went there. Now, I said to this nephew, can you show me a picture of James H. Nichols? He sent me two pictures of his uncle, one from 27 and one from 33. I blew them up. I sent them to Julius Erskine Neighbors, and I said, do you recognize this guy? And I didn't say why. He wrote me back and said, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that's the guy that I witnessed destroy her plane and dug up her body. Okay? I also interviewed Robert Wallach. He's in the film. Wonderful U.S. Marine who found her briefcase in a safe, dry as a bone, kept it for a week. So he had her passport. He had all of her maps, everything, all of her charts. And he turned it over to an officer, and Erskine Neighbors said the same officer is the guy that the briefcase went to, because Erskine was working at Lewis Wallace's tent. So everything went into there. He was the commanding officer. And by the way, Erskine was also tasked to guard the plane for 24 hours. So he went down and guarded that plane, and at some point some Navy brass tried to get in, and he said, I can't let you in. Orders is orders. Now, Thomas Devine reported that incident in his book, but here I was interviewing the guy who actually said it. They didn't know each other.
I love these historical stories.
So I do, too. And you know, I've had people say to me, oh, you know, eyewitness reports are nonsense. They say to me, U.S. Marines can lie. To me, I'm sorry. These guys are telling the truth, as truthful as they can be, and they deserve to hear people's respect, at least to listen to their story. And three of them have died since I did the interviews, and three of them are alive. And, you know, I think they should be honored in some way. And Amelia as well.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, there, I'm sure you've heard the story that she was a spy. I don't know if she was a
spy. We've heard all kinds of things.
Yeah, and she said to somebody, that's been a quote, imagine me being a spy. And I interviewed the son of the police officer, California Highway Patrolman, who claimed that when he was at the Navy at Lockheed in Burbank, he installed two Fairchild spy cameras. Both of those spy cameras would have been used to spy on things. But, of course, she flew over those islands at night. So,
right.
You know, was she a spy? I don't know. But I think she was executed as if she was one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Julia Child, just to throw her in there, you know, she was good friends with FDR. What did he ask her to do? He asked her to spy.
Yeah.
So when Earhart's plane was destroyed in Hawaii, she went to, along with her husband, George Putnam, to FDR and asked for help. And they said, we'll rebuild the plane. And they built this land strip at Howland Island, which was claimed by Japan. But we just sent a Marine in 1933 to claim it. And then Japan complained, and then the guy left. But then we went and built an airstrip just a few years later. And, you know, the first place they bombed, Japan bombed after Pearl Harbor, 4 hours later, was Howland
Island.
That's
right. Let's take some calls here, Rich.
Okay.
Here we go. Final calls. Final hour here. Norma in Downey, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Norma. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Yeah. Rich. Great program.
Thank you.
My question is about suicide. I was told that if you commit suicide, you have to come back and live this same life over again.
Well, I've heard that, Norma, and I appreciate you calling and asking that question. I was just talking about it the other day. We have free will, according to these reports, and things can get really out of hand. And we feel, we choose a lifetime that we feel we can conquer something. But sometimes we get to a point where we fail. We can't conquer it. And people do commit suicide. But when they go back, this is reports from people who've committed suicide in a previous life. When they go back, their soul group says to them, it's okay. Don't beat yourself up. Those people who have committed suicide beat themselves up because they didn't get to learn the lessons, just as you said. You know, they feel awful because they've ruined everybody else's plans, because you've made this elaborate plan with your friends and close ones, and once they check out, it screws everybody else up. But the reports are people don't get upset with the person who's done this because there's no judgment back there. Now, just the other day, I was telling this story where I said, I was, you know, pretending I was a person going, why did I do that? Oh, if I'd only waited until Wednesday, I could have seen, you know, that it would have been okay.
Woulda, shoulda.
Woulda, shoulda. But a woman came up out of the audience and said, I want to talk to you about that Wednesday comment. She said, I had planned my suicide. I went to the store to buy the things so I could do it. And in line were two kids from Uganda. And I started talking to them, and they were part of the Lost Boys of Uganda. And now she's become a filmmaker and is in Uganda helping these kids. So she waited until Wednesday. So now her life has this meaning. So all we can do as loved ones is hope and pray that the person who's gone through that terrible trauma is okay. And the truth is they are okay, because we don't die. We go back to this place. We hope that their acts don't torture everybody else, because everybody has to deal with it, the cleanup and all that stuff that you have to go through. And you hope that that's not too traumatic. But when you get to this thing, when I had my session, I asked my guides, is there anything I can tell people on the planet that's important for them to hear? And they said, tell them, just let go. Let go of judgment. Let go of fear. Let go of anger. Everything is about love. Just make it about love. And so when someone does that, just think of it from a love perspective. I love them. I always love. Oh, I'll give you one other example, Norma. You know the psychic John Edward.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he might be on the show in about a month.
Oh, he's terrific.
Yeah.
But no one knows this story. There was an actress working on the movie Salt, and she told me this story. One day she got a call from John Edward. John said, can I talk to you? Your father is coming through, and he's bugging me. She didn't know who John Edward was. And he said, well, I'm a psychic, and I want you to come to my office. She thought maybe, because he was a pretty actress, you know, maybe he's hitting on her.
Yeah, it's a trick.
So she took her boyfriend to his office. And when he got to the office, John said, your father's coming through, and he wants you to call your mother in Michigan. Now, this actress told me she had told no one that her father had committed suicide. So she calls her mom. Mom, I'm with John Edward. Now, the mom knew who he was.
Okay.
Oh, my God. And John says, your father, your husband, wants you to go downstairs in your house. There's a book that he wants you to find. And he directs her. No, not that room. Keep going to the end of the hall. Get on the chair. She gets on the chair. She pulls down this red folder, and it's a picture. It's pictures of the husband, her father, when he was happy before he got depressed and before suicide.
And did himself.
And he said, I want you to remember me as I was, because that's how I am now. And then John turned to the girl and said, oh, and your father says you should marry your boyfriend because you're pregnant.
Whoa.
They didn't know that.
They didn't know she was pregnant?
They didn't know she was pregnant. And when I was working on the movie, they just had their kid together.
I love it.
So suicide happens for a variety of reasons, and it's really hard to say, don't judge.
That's a good one. Rich, we're going to come back. We'll talk a little bit more about that and take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM Worldwide. On our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, noted attorney Robert Shapiro joins us. As you know, we support his Brent Shapiro Foundation. We'll talk about that and some other issues. And then later on in the show, Jeffrey Smith joins us, genetically modified foods with some startling new information. So make sure you're part of that program. And when we come back with Rich Martini, let's take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Rich, before we take final calls, the church always talked about suicides. You'll never get to heaven. I never believed that. Ever believed that.
Well, you wonder why, you know, that whole concept of the church telling us who gets in and who doesn't get in. It's a little loopy when you sort of examine people's lives and who they are. And, you know, for the longest time, there was limbo, one of my favorite places, where, you know, souls supposedly went who weren't baptized. And then, you know, they dispensed with limbo.
They got rid of limbo.
Yeah, so where'd those souls go?
It's gone.
You know. Anyway, blessed, you know, listen, I found that this research enhances religion. When Jesus says, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, love your neighbor because he is yourself. I see it now in a different light. A lot of these things that are said by every religion about the nature of love, it really reinforces it for me.
All right, final calls. We go, first of all, to Blair and Sedona, Arizona. Hey, Blair, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, George. And Mr. Martini, I was recently turned on to Michael Newton's books thanks to my hosts living outside of Jakarta, Indonesia, during a trip I took this April. Cool. By the way, I'm halfway through Destiny of Souls on spiritual energy restoration, if you have a chance to comment on that. But what I'd like to bring up has to do with the Urantia book. Back in July, George had a guest named Mr. Ballestos, who talked about the Urantia book studies he's been doing, whereby he believes reincarnational lives are part of the Lucifer rebellion scheme to keep us continually down in the lower realms on Earth, sort of trapped down here. What do you say to that?
Well, listen, let me just tell you a story. I think that's great you're reading Michael Newton's books, all four of them. I highly recommend them. What people will tell you about my book, it's a little more colloquial. As you can hear my voice, I'm a little goofier. It's not so clinical. But in terms of reincarnation and where does it come from, when I was working on SALT, this New York detective pulled me aside. We had an advisor, you know, NYPD guy, 9/11. He had been there and gone through that. And he pulled me into a room and he locked the door. And he said, I heard you talking about this past life, this reincarnation stuff. I think my house is haunted by Satan. I said, oh, whoa, whoa, what makes you say that? He says, well, first my daughter tells me my daughter tells me there's a ghost in the kitchen, and now she starts talking about reincarnation. Is my house possessed? And I said, well, hold on. First of all, you're talking to a Guido working on a movie set. That aside, what is it about this ghost? And he said, well, that's the funny thing. She said that he looks just like you, Dad. He dresses like you. He's a cop. And so this detective pulled out a photograph of his partner who had died 10 years ago. The daughter was 8.
Jeez.
She said, that's him, except he's younger now. And he looked at me and said, how could that be? I said, well, you know, the research shows people present themselves as they remember, as they want to be presented. It's up to them, you know, to look healthy and fit. And I said, did you like the guy? He goes, I loved him. I said, well, then it's not so bad that the guy you loved is hanging around, is it? That's not so bad. He went, no. He goes, well, what about the reincarnation stuff? I said, well, listen, when kids are making up stories about reincarnation or making up stories, they're all the details are all over the map. But if it's a memory, then they kind of stay the same. So why don't you pull out a map of Australia and ask her? This is what parents don't do. Ask their kids a question they don't know the answer to.
Right.
I tell people, ask your kids if they chose you or you chose them. Simple question. So the cop comes in the next day, grabs me by the collar, pulls me into a room, locks the door. He says, I put a map out. She suddenly said, Dad, I was from Perth. She pointed to Perth. She said, I was a farmer. I was a man. I had a wife, I had 2 kids, and we all died in a drought. And then she burst into tears. But because he had listened to her, that was her way to get past that emotional experience. And, you know, in terms of people that come on, and my feeling is real simple. I say the same thing when I talk to people about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That was written by one monk. And if 2 monks have the identical experience, then you can sort of examine it. Newton's work, 7,000 people over 30 years, identical experience. I'm just talking about 15 people that I've chosen who never heard of Michael Newton's work or casually knew about it. I filmed them, identical experiences, same thing. Past life memory, in between lives, talking to a spirit guide, learning about the deep mysteries of life. That's a wonderful thing to examine. I'm not saying it's the end all to be all. I'm not saying toss your religion away. I'm saying, okay, this is another arrow in our quiver to figure out what spirituality is. You know, doctors deal with people in terms of genetics and then, you know, nature and nurture, sociological issues and genetics. And I'm saying there's a third issue that has to be addressed. There's a spiritual journey everybody takes. It doesn't have to outweigh the other two. You examine all three. But like the Holy Trinity, you know, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. I mean, I think that literally is, it's, you know, source, human, and consciousness. That's what those three things really represent. And it accurately describes who we are on the planet.
Okay, back we go. Kevin in Mayer, Arizona, it is your turn. Go ahead, Kev.
gentlemen, you have really answered a lot of questions. I've been listening right from the beginning, pretty much. Get a little fade in and fade out. But back in 1990, I had suffered a loss and lost a member of my family. Through work, I was referred to a gentleman who did hypnosis.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I'm curious about, one thing, it changed my whole life. It took about 4 months of therapy, and I went through the past life and through hypnosis. But I'm very curious. You know, it just opened up a lot of pages and was like it was more like the deaths when I would die.
Uh-huh.
I could see those things. And first it started in like a vivid color sometime in the 40s. Then another one went to, like in maybe the, late 1800s. It was like being put on a ship and then sailing and then dying on the ship and being buried at sea. And then they went back and back, but they got more fainter and they were more like getting fainter. They were more like a golden brown experience, and I kept on going back. But the gentleman who was putting me through this therapy, I went back to him in 1991 to get a referral back to him, and they told me he passed over.
Hmm.
And the thing was, when he was doing one of my last sessions with me, it was like about four times that I went into this past life thing at four different times. And each time I was going back. But then when I got to a certain level, then I was being drawn back through time and bring back into the present. But it was almost like deja vu of things that have happened in my life since that period of time.
Right.
And with these deja vus, there was something where when I came out of it, he was gone.
Right.
And then I got up and I woke up and, I just got up slowly and I had been there several times. And I went back to the desk where I would come in and, it was like different. I'm wondering, when did there was something that happened in that session that, I don't know, I think.
Well, I'll tell you, when these sessions usually happen, they'll say, take us to a significant lifetime that has some influence on this life. So people might remember something that happened. I mean, in the book, there was a woman that I know pretty well, very well, and she was having a lot of stress over her mom had died, and her job had ended, and she had to sell her home and stuff like that. And so I suggested that maybe this hypnotherapy would be helpful to her. And so Scott, we did it over her house. And he said, let's go to a significant life that has some influence on this life. And she said, she went back to the year 18, and she was in Jerusalem. Now, the odd thing was that Scott and I had the night before been talking about people who had recounted knowing Jesus or living a life where Jesus lived and how he had profoundly influenced so many different people. And I said, gee, it would be great if you asked people what he looked like, because if they said he had green eyes and red hair.
It looks like the Shroud of Turin.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Whatever they say, though, but if they say something that's the same, then you can kind of examine it. Okay. So now here we are doing the session. She says, it's the year 18. I'm in Jerusalem. I'm like a gypsy girl. I like sort of an itinerant person, and I make jewelry. So I pass Scott a note. Ask her if she knows Jesus. And eventually, they don't do it directly. In the documentary, there's this thing, and I had to cut to it, but basically, he asks her a number of questions, and eventually he says, did you know anybody by the name of Jesus? And she pauses and says, I'm completely mesmerized. I see the face of Jesus. And how far are you away from him? I'm 10 feet away. And please describe it. And she then describes him in great detail. And through tears, she talks about everything this guy says is so filled with love and compassion. The jaded skeptic that I am, I'm thinking to myself, well, the Romans didn't hear him that way. That's not what they heard when he spoke. But here she is experiencing that. And at some point, Scott then says, so why did this lifetime come here now? And she says, because I was fearless in that life. That lifetime was fearless because I knew Jesus and I had all these other experiences in my life. I feared nothing. And Scott said, well, is there any way you can bring that fearlessness into this life? Can you ask her to transfer some of that to your life now? And in front of me, she transformed, because all these fears about what was going to happen in her life and et cetera, and when she came out of it, all I can say is she's a completely changed person. Now, here's the weird thing, and I've known this woman a long time. She's as far from being religious as you can imagine. And we noticed around her house are crosses, but not like, you know, traditional stuff, like crosses everywhere. And, you know, Scott, like, tapped me on the shoulder and said, look, you know, and they were everywhere. So we asked her, like, why do you collect crosses? She says, I have no idea. It's just something that I've always thought was kind of cool. Anyway, the point is just that when you do these sessions, the thing that's most important for you to remember pops into your mind, and that's why it's there. And one other thing I wanted to mention, Robert Beer, I had mentioned him earlier. So he went and did a session, and he saw his daughter who had passed away. He spent an hour hanging out with her. She was one of his spirit guides. But what's really fascinating about his session, he remembered a past life in Boston in 1840, being a banker, married to a woman, let's say her name is Elizabeth. After the session, he said, I know Elizabeth. I knew her in this lifetime, but she was my wife back then. I said, well, this is a great opportunity. So I arranged for Elizabeth, who knew nothing about Robert Beer's session. I arranged for her to see a hypnotherapist in New York City, who knew nothing about Robert Beer's session in London. She went and did a session. She had the identical past life memory of being married to him in Boston in the 1840s.
Amazing. Couple more calls. We're done. Dade City, Florida. First time caller, Shannon. Hi, Shannon.
Yes. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Morning.
Thank you.
Morning. Good. Yes. First time caller to any talk show ever.
Cool.
And I felt compelled to call just, Mr. Martini, you're just hitting home with so many things. I mean, since I was just a little kid. And there's just not a lot of people you can talk to about, you know, some of these weird experiences or different
right,
ones.
Right, exactly. I totally agree. Well, I found places online, you know. If you look around, you'll find some.
Well, and you were talking about the therapist, and I've been taking notes, writing down different authors and whatnot, you know, you've been talking about. On these therapists.
Where do you live? What state are you in?
Florida.
In Florida.
Okay. Whereabouts in Florida?
Close to Tampa, about 45 minutes south of Tampa.
The NewtonInstitute.org website has a list of everyone who's gone through their training. And I can recommend them because they've had extensive training in this area. So if you want to do a session, and they usually do two sessions. They do one session that's a past life session, and then the second one is the between.
Interesting. Sessions. What's it cost, by the way?
Well, it depends on the person. And, like, you know, generally it's about $100 an hour, let's say. So if you have a four-hour session, they usually give you a flat rate. You know, it's $400 or it's $500. My experience, though, and sometimes they do it over a couple sessions. So you might just want to do a past life regression. That might be, you know, $200 or whatever it is, whatever the market will bear in that area. But for my money, you know, somebody can show me all my past lives. You know, listen, I saw myself as quite a few different characters. I had at least a dozen, and I saw everything about them, their deaths, all that stuff, just like the caller's saying, you know, you go through all that stuff. But I think it's worth every nickel, which is, you know, to get insight into, and this is key, if we reincarnate, doesn't it make sense to leave the planet healthy, clean air, clean water, so we can come back to it?
Yep. You would think so.
you would think so.
Shannon, thank you. Carrie in Idaho, let's squeeze you in real fast. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. It's the first time I ever got through since 19.
Well, and unfortunately, you only got about a minute left, so go ahead.
Okay, I'll talk fast. It was on me. I studied all my life and took Revelation seminars, church groups, anything I could on Revelations. And
Thank you.
The 7,000 years is up in December, and that would be the time Christ would leave the room he's been in, forgiving our sins, and it comes out and says, you know, just or just, those that are unjust.
Well, revelation right around the corner if you're
into that. Well, all I can say is if you get two people who say the same thing, then I'd want to examine it. But I have yet to see that. I've got 7,000 people who say the same thing about there not being any end of the world coming up, and that we continue on, and that we never die. We don't die. There are reports that we've been on other planets that we've destroyed by accident. Okay, I've heard at least two people who claim that. But in terms of Earth, people see us way in the future. People, you know, they're not exactly, when you do this kind of work, it's the likely outcome of what might happen. But they don't predict the future the way, you know, pundits do.
And your animals, your favorite pets, your dog, what happens
to
them?
Well, according to them, they have their own realms.
That's good.
Animals of the earth, animals of the air, and animals of the sea, all in their own realms. But if you have a pet or somebody, you can hang out with them. And I just want to mention real quickly, My Life Between Life, it's a book written by Galen Stoller. This friend of mine's son died at 16, but he contacted his father from the other side and got his father, who's a renowned pediatrician, to write a book about what he's experiencing. And just the other day, this woman said, my husband recommended this book, My Life Between Life, from the other side.
Well, that's super. And all yours are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Thank you, Rich. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottesteur, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John P. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.